Yeah, Frank here has got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's what do you call it, Kramer?
Billiard room.
No, not billiard. Not the billiards. It was...
Billiards room.
Come on already. Come on. We call it the...
The place to be.
The place to be. Yes, the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can.
Time to play the game!
Well, you always left me satisfied and smiling, so...
But that's what she said.
Why do I want this? I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Place to be nations. Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Like, I can't understand a word he says. He mumbles. He sounds like he's on, you know, 50 and Ambien when he's on the show.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
And then they trash him and say he's a fucking pill-popping, you know, pothead or whatever when he left. I don't know if it's his misshapen body or his shorts that are pulled up over his belly button, his stupid sandals. I don't know what it is. I don't know the fuck the Department of Health is.
To do worse than Josh Richard.
We die. Nigga, ask the bartender if you think we lie. But if you think we hot, nigga, think again. Because when it's sink or swim, you got to think to win. And if I drink this in, everybody will know it. Because I ain't going for it. So pray to the Lord that I don't pull out. Cuss out and bust out. Go to nigga proud. Make the trigger shout. You can try to smoke an ounce to this. Well, I pronounce this shit. Baby, bounce them tips. I'ma move them hips. Baby, shake them cheeks. I got dick for days.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, and for the moment, I am without my partner in crime, Scott. He is held up at a personal engagement, but I am not flying solo, because with me is the one and only, the voice of Ring of Honor, the great Kevin Kelly. Kevin, welcome back.
It's great to be back with you, Justin, and we barely miss Scott's presence. It's
barely.
Like, what does he really contribute to the show? Maybe we need to take a look at that.
I think we need to review things. I think it's almost time for his yearly bonus review anyway, so we'll factor this in.
That poor guy.
Yeah, poor guy indeed. He's got a lot going on. So he will be joining us shortly, though. When he does, we'll make sure we give him a warm welcome. But we wanted to pick up where we left off last time. We decided as we were going through 97 that Montreal and the aftermath was such a big fiasco and such a big event in the WWF that we needed to save a whole show for that. But we do have a few things before we get into that. So when we left off, we were in, I think, like early October. We talked about Brian Pillman's passing and the fallout from all that. But one thing I wanted to discuss before we get to Montreal was the return of Jeff Jarrett. He was pretty much the first defector from WCW, one of the first major guys to come back the other way. What was the thinking like at the time? Was that a big deal inside the WWF Titan Towers, or what was the thought process behind it?
It was very interesting because, yes, it was a big deal. We felt like, yes, like you said, it was the first defection of somebody that was coming back our way, and Jeff Jarrett was perceived as a great catch for the WWF, working very closely with Vince Russo at that time, especially on the magazine side. You know, it was a big deal to Russo. He and Jeff always got along very well. And I think his belief was that now they had another main event star who could, you know, help level the playing field between what we had currently had and what we had lost to WCW. However, there was one guy who did not share that belief, who didn't voice those beliefs with any of us in the tower, but quite plainly made it known exactly what he felt about Jeff Jarrett, and that was Stone Cold Steve Austin.
So he had issues with the Jarrett family, right, dating back to his time in, was it USWA?
Yeah, going back to his time in Memphis, and Steve had a very long memory, and never, ever, ever, ever forgot. So that was... That was how that went.
So what was the thinking with Jarrett's gimmick? It was almost like a non-gimmick, but he came in and they did all those kind of shoot interviews with him, you know, ripping on WCW and ripping on Vince McMahon and the WWF, and then they had him do the whole, like, bait-and-switch thing where he'd come out and pretend he was going to fight and then, you know, walk away at the last minute and kind of a gaudy outfit and all that. Was that him or was it a Russo thing?
I think that was, you know, a lot of brainstorming between him and Russo, and they felt like, I think they had a clear idea and designs of what they wanted to do about the way they wanted Jeff to be perceived, that he was a star and that kind of the rules didn't apply to him. Because let's face it, he's not the biggest guy.
Right.
And sometimes the smallest dog has to have the loudest bark. So mm-hmm. I felt like that was part of the point of view. And it felt like a breath of fresh air too, because again, wrestling and especially the WWF was morphing out of, you know, the cartoony wrestling period that it had gone through in the mid 90s and even through the 80s, you know, the WWF always had that kind of that antiseptic feel about it.
Right.
And so when Jarrett was coming out, it, kind of taking a page from Stone Cold's book, it was like another breath of fresh air. But not only was the perception with Steve that Jarrett was ripping him off, but this is the same guy that, you know, and I mean, let's tell the story the way it is. He gets in the ring, cuts the promo, and talks about how Stone Cold is blaspheming, you know, with Austin 316,
mm-hmm.
and Jarrett was dead.
Yep.
You know, that was it. Put a bullet in the back of his career as far as the WWF is concerned. Austin would never, ever, 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 ever work with him. I think the only thing that they ever did together is one time Austin gave him a stunner, and that was it.
And it took Jarrett a while to recover. I mean, it was, you know, he didn't do much of anything throughout 1998, and it wasn't until he started doing the whole, like, you know, women beating thing in 99 that he would kind of recapture any momentum.
I mean, look at all of the effort that they put to Jeff.
Yes.
And Jeff didn't quit. You know what I mean? A lot of lesser guys who, you know, could have seen the handwriting on the wall, could have collected their money because he got a good downside guarantee, could have collected their money and just not given a damn. But Jeff was hell-bent and determined to get over and would do everything that he could to do so. And, I mean, again, he had everything. He had the guitar. He had Deborah. He had the women gimmick. He had the figure four. My gosh, what else could they have done?
Even before that, he had the Tennessee Lee. And then he did the whole thing where at the NWA, and then that goes away, and he goes back to being the country singer and then everything else. Yeah, you're right. They went through a lot for him.
It was a lot of effort to try to get him over. And, I mean, that's one of those things where guys, you just push and push and push. And what eventually got him over and where he got to be his biggest was when they didn't re-sign him.
Right.
And then he walked away and held the company up for money and said, oh, by the way, I'll take what was owed to me when y'all reduced my downside.
Yep.
So he wound up even.
At the time, yes. But now in the long run, he's not. Doesn't seem like it. You think he'd ever be welcomed back by Vince? I mean, it seems like Vince has forgiven a lot of people.
It's good. You know what? I think without, were it not for TNA, yes.
Okay.
I think because of Vince's long relationship with Jerry Jarrett and his love and respect for Jerry Lawler, that were it not for his, you know, time in TNA, Jeff Jarrett would be welcome back.
Well, I guess time will tell. Maybe someday he'll, when they're running low on Hall of Fame inductees, they'll bring him back when they need him.
Well, if TNA goes away.
Right. Well, he's kind of distanced himself from it in a way anyway. He's no longer part of the ownership, right? Isn't that I don't think so anyway.
Well, he might still be percentage-wise, but
right.
Again, it's the perception.
Okay.
You'll never see AJ Styles in a WWE ring. You'll never see Samoa Joe. You'll never see any of the top guys in TNA in the WWE ever, because that would be the validation that the promotion would need. WWE will never give it to him. That's another story for another time.
Yes, it is. We'll have to do a current state of the business podcast with you soon. So back to 97. And speaking of shoot promos, another infamous set of shoot promos at the time came from the mouth of Jim Cornette. And what was the thinking behind that? Was that Cornette's brainchild or another Russo thing, another brainstorm idea to have Cornette go out there and to start, you know, ripping on everything, mainly WCW, but even some internal things. And the whole, you know, the classic one is where he ripped apart Phil Mushnick, who, of course, nobody likes. So where did that all come from? And what was the feel backstage about it?
I think it was the idea that I'm sure it was Vince Russo's idea and pitched it to Vince McMahon, who then the two of them probably sold it to Cornette. Cornette did it, you know, it was an opportunity for him to voice his opinion and clear the air and get some things off of his chest and, do what he felt was good for business. He knew that he could do this and do it well, be very entertaining at it. And, you know, it was kind of an extension of what Cornette had occasionally written in the Raw magazine too, so that there was some logic behind it. That he didn't just come across as this bitter guy, but that it was also going to lead to what they would eventually do, like with the whole NWA thing. He recorded them at the studio in Stamford, Connecticut, and I think I was there for the first one, And I think he did it in one take. In fact, I'm 100% sure he did it in one take. And we all just kind of looked at each other like, well, that's that. Yeah. All right, we're wrapped. Good. Perfect. And that was it. You know, however long it took him to say his piece, that's how long it took to record it. So, yeah, it was just that good.
Yeah, I mean, they were great. I mean, of course, the best line was the whole, you know, they say Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage or whoever, or Roddy Piper are household names, but so is garbage. whatever. I forget the exact line, but it was something along those lines.
There were so many classic one-liners out of Cornette.
Yeah, that was some good stuff. I mean, you could definitely feel the overall change of the promotion during this time, like you said. I mean, just the you know, attitude hadn't started yet, but it was clearly seeping in, and just very angry in the fall of '97, a very dark kind of feel.
And that was what the whole thing was. If everybody's angry, then nobody's angry.
Right.
You know, and that the anger should be spread apart. Everybody was bitter and held down and held back and not going to take it anymore. And what the sad thing is that you, again, State of the Business Today, we'll do that show down the road. You go to, you know, any indie show and most regional promotions today, and you'll find the exact same promo being cut, you know, in the ring by guys who don't have a clue, you know, and have no reason to say that they're bitter and held down and held back.
Right, right.
Because in the words of Bill Dundee, they couldn't draw 15 cents in Chinese money. So. But again, another time, another show. We've got a lot of these Place to Be podcasts. You know, we just keep racking them up. So
that's right. We'll just keep putting them down. All right. So Scott's actually joined us now, Kevin. So just in time here to get into Montreal. And speaking of angry men, he's with us now. So
thank God you're here, Scott, because like I was saying before we got on the air with Justin, thank God you're here. You're the most valuable member of this team. And we couldn't do this without you. You don't even have to listen to the beginning of the show because it was a struggle. It'll just aggravate you. But really, the show begins now. Thank goodness.
Of course.
Well, Kevin,
like the relationship between Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby Heenan, you know, to all, both sides of everyone's mouth, of course.
Kevin, though, I didn't even record that first part. I think you got really angry with me for like a split second, and then I said, "No, we did. We recorded, Kevin. It's okay."
I was seriously angry.
Well, it was really good. See,
there you go. Okay.
All right, let's get into Montreal. Well, at least the build up to it. Backstage, what were things like? At what point did everyone know Brett was leaving? The negotiations going on. I mean, we've seen it all in Wrestling with Shadows afterwards, but at the time, Kevin, just kind of give us a little timeline starting in like mid October.
I think there was a collective sense of disbelief and no, it's not really going to happen. Yeah, I guess it is going to happen. No, it can't happen. Yeah, it looks like it's going to happen. Well, how are we going to get out of this one? And it just became like sort of that ongoing, you know, it was sort of like the, you know, like any type of grief type of thing. You go through the, you know, denial, anger, bargaining, acceptance, that type of deal.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of like that. I think there were people that felt like it was that something was up and that it wasn't ever really going to happen, that somehow these two guys would come together. But then it came to be that, yeah, he was pretty much done. And he was going to leave. And so now what do we do? How do we get out of this one?
It seemed like, Kev, that Vince, you know, Vince signed this big contract with Brett, the year before. And it almost just seems like Vince didn't even give Brett a chance to like counter it. Like, you know what? I can't afford you. You can leave. Like, what if, you know, almost like he didn't give Brett a chance to say, well, no, let's talk about it. I could work around it. Don't, you know, it's all, it seemed like Vince was just happy to let him go. Did you get that feeling, or did people get that feeling that Vince just wanted to cut him loose anyway and didn't give him a chance to want to stay?
Again, depends on who you talk to. I think that the belief of everyone at, you know, as the story began to come out that Vince really couldn't, you know, afford to keep Brett under this contract, that he was doing him a favor by letting him go, and that Vince was not going to penalize Brett for his loyalty. Then there were the others that did believe maybe Vince doesn't really want Bret Hart here. Maybe Vince is choosing sides, and maybe Vince is choosing Shawn over Brett, because the two really could not coexist. And I think that I always leaned more toward the side of sneaky Vince as opposed to benevolent Vince.
Mm-hmm.
And I again had a feeling that was the where, and again, more events as they unfolded after the fact kind of proved that to me, that, you know, my assertions were correct. And I wasn't alone. There were, you know, it was pretty much split down the middle.
Was any of the financial crisis thing legit, or was that all just spin for the Bret Hart part of it?
Well, as far as we know, I mean, we never actually looked at the books or hired our own accountants to delve into things. But what we were told is that Vince and Linda personally had lost $5 million, you know, beginning, you know, the end of 96. Mm-hmm. And that was reflected in our profit sharing that year, which we didn't get any because there weren't any profits. And Vince and Linda, up until that point, had always been very upfront and honest with everybody and had reported, hey, this was a great year. We made this. Here was your profit sharing. Profit sharing was very generous. Mm-hmm. It was upwards of 15% of your salary. Wow. You got as a bonus. So it was really nice. And a lot of, you know, the employees, you know, the tape ops and the folks that worked in accounting and human resources, they all benefited from that. So when business was bad, we all knew it. And when business was good, we all knew it. We celebrated it when it was good, and we pulled together when it was bad. So there wasn't a big belief that that there was any nonsense being thrown our way. We believed that Vince and Linda could not afford to keep Bret around under that contract.
Okay, so as we head closer to Montreal now, word leaks out. I think it was about a week before, you know, we find out that Bret's leaving for WCW. You know, what was the feel that final week going into the show, or even just, you know, if there's not much difference, but even into Montreal that night, just during the night leading up to the match, what was, I mean, did it just feel like another guy leaving, or not just another guy? I know it's a big deal for Bret to go, but was there any, I guess what I'm trying to say is, was there any feel about what was going to go down, or did it feel like just a guy leaving?
No, it was sort of in the middle, and I'll give you the perfect example of this. Vince Russo's office was directly across the hall from me. On the second floor of Titan Tower. So midweek, probably Thursday, I had a magazine question. Vince was, you know, door was closed. I knew he was on the phone, didn't know what he was doing. Poked my head in real quick, holding up the magazine thing that I needed him to look at. Sometimes if he was on a call, he could just mute the call and do that. Anyway, so he told me to be quiet, come in, and he was listening in, spying on Vince McMahon's direction, to a call that Vince was making with Bret Hart. The two of them were talking, and unbeknownst to Bret, Vince Russo was listening in. So the call was muted, and Vince could do whatever he wanted to do. So he looks at the magazine thing, and he signs off on this, and then he explains to me what's going on, tells me that he's listening in on Vince's instruction, and that Bret is being extremely unreasonable. I'm like, what do you mean, as far as Saturday? You know, as far as dropping the belt? Oh, well, like what? You know, as far as Sunday is concerned. Every scenario that we're giving him, no, he won't do it. No, he's just not going to put Sean over. There's no way. Every scenario, yeah, we're throwing every scenario at him. Even Davey and Owen have pitched scenarios, and Neidhart's pitched scenarios. No, he won't do anything with any of the family. He won't do anything for anybody. Wow. That's going to be interesting on Sunday. Oh, I'll say it is. All right, thanks for signing my magazine thing. See you later. And that was it. So I knew something was up, and then we covered it kind of like we had always done with Bret. We were there covering it, doing the thing on the AOL site, and covered it like it was a shoot. It's the way I always do everything. I try to make it as real as possible, because there are very real elements in everything that these guys do. I make that argument all the time. And when it came to Bret, this was very, very real. So little did we know that this was going to happen when we got to the building, because none of us were privy to what the actual plan was that night. We did not know anything when we got to the building. And, you know, of course, history now, you know, all the, you know, everybody that was involved, you know, all the conspirators. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, it was a very, very interesting scene.
You're the first one, Kevin, that I've ever heard say that, that even his own, like Owen and Bulldog, were even giving him ideas on how to. Clearly, they weren't Sean fans either, most likely. But I find it, you're the first one I've heard actually say that even his relatives were coming up with ideas to do it, and he wouldn't even listen to them. That's fascinating. I've never heard that before. That's crazy.
Well, part of it, I think, was there, you know, was Brett's paranoia at the time. And I say that only because I think there was a part of Brett that felt like, you know, these guys were kind of in it for themselves. I think all wrestlers, to a certain extent, are paranoid, and maybe he wasn't looking at it like family as he was looking at it like somebody who's trying to take his spot or do something like that. But the scenarios were very plausible, that basically DQ, you know, Davey runs in, Owen, Neidhart, they all run in, DQ, and then Brett comes out the next night, tips his cap, hands the belt over, and that's the end of it. No, I don't want to do that. Okay, what's wrong with that idea? And it was like, no, that's just, you know, those guys just trying to get themselves over at my expense. Well, what do you want to do?
To say that about your own brother, that's weird.
Wow. I think it was more Davey than I think it was more Davey and Neidhart than Owen.
Probably, yeah, but that would make more sense.
That actually would make more sense.
I mean, Kevin, do you feel Brett was justified in these beliefs, or do you think he was taking things a little too far with the whole, you know, they're going to assassinate my character if I lose to Sean, I'm not jobbing a hand. Like, do you think it was all just over the top and too much, or do you think he was legit in those beliefs?
I always have, and always will have great respect for Brett as a person, as an athlete, as a family man, as everything. But I think he was completely wrong in this scenario. I think he was, but who's to say that if it was me in that same situation, that I wouldn't feel the exact same way that he did. But I can say, I said it then, I say it now, he was wrong. And, you know, but with all due respect, we're all entitled to differences of opinion. He's certainly justified for feeling the way that he did, but I disagree with it.
I mean, don't you think in a way he almost comes off as more of a, I don't say a hero, but in this regard, you know, more of a hero. If he just does, I mean, isn't he more sympathetic if he just does the job and then he can go out and say, hey, you know, I love the business. I did the right thing for the business. I laid down. I put this guy I hate over, and they still treat me like shit and all this stuff. You know, doesn't that put him in a better position than the guy who, you know, refused to do business, and whether he was right or wrong in his own mind, and just kind of went out the way he did? Because he'd always been kind of, you know, such a classy guy and the guy who always did the right thing for the legitimacy of the sport. It seems like just very against his character in a way to not just do it and then maybe, you know, use that later on his behalf.
Well, I'll give you the two sides of the coin. Would we still be talking about this match 17 years later?
No, definitely not.
If Brett would have just gone out there and done the normal thing. And the end result of that was what? Brett lost. Brett got beat. Referee called for the bell. Shawn Michaels got his hand raised and was the new WWF champion. There are still some conspiracy theorists out there who I always entertain those beliefs that you know, this may have been what they wanted to go down all along. And that while, you know, Brett may have known about it, Sean may have known about it, everybody may have known about it, we might be the only ones on the outside still talking about to this day. The end result was Shawn Michaels beat Bret Hart and became the new WWF champion. Bret Hart left the company, went to WCW, where he made a lot of guaranteed coin.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, aside from the way Brett wound up his active wrestling career with the concussions and things like that, I think everybody turned out all right based upon what had happened that night in Montreal.
All right, Kevin, eliminate for us or continue the conspiracy thoughts, but any chance that this was all a work and Brett was involved?
I would say it's as much a chance that it was all a work as that it was all legit, or that it was all, you know, that Brett was surprised by what happened.
Interesting.
I think it's clean enough. It's a clean enough hit that there's plausible deniability from everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't, and yet there's no fingerprints on anyone to say, well, they definitely knew or they definitely didn't know. It's a perfect murder. It's the greatest crime ever committed, because either they're all keeping quiet, but see, again, I think they can keep quiet because they've all made a lot of money on it. If
right.
Brett comes out and says, now I really knew all about it, then what does that do?
Yep.
I think that hurts his legacy. You know, Bret Hart is still that sympathetic character for getting done over by Vince McMahon, the evil billionaire,
mm-hmm.
and by Shawn Michaels, you know, because again, which side of the argument were you on? If you were a Brett guy, you hated Sean. And if you were a Brett guy, you hated Vince McMahon for the way he treated you all through 97. You hated Vince McMahon for screwing you out of your guaranteed contract, for not wanting to honor, you know, creative control as was, you know, deemed in the contract, not being a man of your word, not holding up your end of the bargain, and screwing me and not wanting to do things the way I wanted to do. I was always an honorable guy, and I never wanted to be, I never treated anybody that way, and I wasn't about to be treated on my way out the door. So those fans, those core fans, still believe in Bret Hart. And if Bret came out and said, you know, I knew all about it all along, I think a lot of those fans would be pissed off.
Right.
You know, really.
And they put their faith in him, kind of like the, you know, the Von Erich fans in Texas. Mm-hmm. With all the death and suicide and drugs, eventually, you know, the family just got to be such a drain on their legacy that eventually the people who believed in him and gave it all their heart and soul to them said, we don't believe in you anymore. And they stopped going to wrestling matches. So I think there's, if Brett ever led on that they knew about it, and you know, the only thing that was a, to where I could say it's definitely could not have been a work, is because Shawn Michaels, after the fact, was pretty much a raging asshole all the way through 98 till he eventually went away.
Mm-hmm.
If he knew that Brett was in on it,
right,
he probably would have blabbed.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to keep something like this for, you know, 16 years or whatever, or 13 years.
And the only thing I think of is that they tied some financial gain to his silence. I mean, that would be the only way you could explain to him not ever saying anything. But still, you got to think, as you know, drugged up as he was half the time, it would have came out at some point, you would think.
Because he was getting his $750,000 a year contract, you know, guaranteed, paid to him.
Although he never said, I mean, he never let on for a long time that he was in on it, at least publicly. I mean, was that a common thing backstage, well known? Because it seemed like he didn't really admit it until he came back in like 02.
Right, and that was just the time that needed to happen. But I guess the two of them sat down and did the big interview together at some point.
Shawn and Brett, last year they did it. And
last year,
the DVD was
my building. Yeah.
Yeah, the DVD was interesting. It was good, but it was really just Brett like ripping on Shawn, and Shawn just taking the verbal beating. But
Shawn just was like, I was a bad guy.
Yeah, exactly.
I did a lot of things.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, it's funny you bring that up, Kevin, because just to kind of on a side note about that interview, it was actually recorded in our building at Harbor Plaza, and I watched most of it while the guys were recording it. And you have a tale of two guys, Brett, who obviously has a memory like an elephant and forgets nothing, and Shawn, who I don't think really remembers much of anything.
No.
He can't deliver. Like I always say, and JR and I have had this conversation many times off air and on, Shawn still doesn't – I still believe Shawn wants to feel innocent. He doesn't want to admit that he was in on it or whose idea it was. You know, I've read stuff where people say it was Triple H's idea, and Shawn and Vince went for it. I don't believe that, but you know, a lot of
course
people.
Of course not. You're a Triple H fanboy.
Well, no, of course I don't want to believe he's a bad guy. Well, at this point, who cares? But hey, you know what?
Really?
Oh God, he's the worst, Kevin. Such an apologist.
Scott, how do you look at this guy?
He loves him.
Look at this guy, and just not realize that he is this biggest scum. Come on.
He's here for the good of the business.
He loves him.
Why did you start this? What was I talking about? Can we get back to the point, please?
Yes. I think everything you may say now is invalid to Kevin, unfortunately.
That's true. That might be another entire podcast. I'm curious to hear that side of the point, too. No, Shawn just, like, you almost feel like Shawn's still holding something back, just the way he delivers it. Like, he always says, you know, when I was doing that, you know, I feel like at the time when I was there, you know,
I have a different.
Shawn, just get it out, you know.
I have a different take on it. I think it's more that Shawn seems like he's someone that's more, I don't want to say at peace with himself, but he's kind of moved on and doesn't really care about all that. He just wants to like go on and live on his ranch and do whatever with his kids. And Brett seems to be the guy that kind of still has this baggage on him. And to me, that seems more like it's almost like the kid. Say you were like picked on in high school or something, and then you go back to your reunion. And you go like, you know, let it out with this bully, and the bully's like, I don't remember who you are. Like, to me, that's what it felt like. Like, Shawn Michaels was this bully, and Brett was picked on and picked on and picked on, and then they finally meet back up, and Brett is like, you did this to me, you did that to me, you did this to me, and Shawn is just kind of like, all right, you know, sorry, I didn't mean to, but it happened.
I think the other thing is, deep down, I think Brett's upset that he got robbed of the years that Sean now got from 2002 until he retired in 2010. You know, the concussion against Goldberg and then the stroke, and he had to retire and he couldn't. I think he's still a little jealous of Sean. That Sean got the comeback. I think Brett never got the comeback, and obviously his WCW career was not stellar, mostly because the booking sucked. But you know, he didn't get that chance to come back in 2002. Like Brett, like, I mean, if Brett was healthy and didn't have the concussion, he was able to come back in 2002. Boy, how cool would that have been?
Kevin, do you think he would have came back sooner if not for the Owen Hart stuff?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Most definitely. They would have been able to put the past in the past, I'm sure. Owen always held the belief that he could get Vince and Brett and lock them in a room together and sneak out. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And Owen had said this on a number of occasions. And just let them fight it out, yell and scream and whatever, and eventually at the end they would hug and be friends again. So yeah, and that was post Montreal, of course, before Owen died. So, but I think everything changed once Owen passed away, and then it just became way too complicated. It became so much more than just this match in Montreal. You know, it was this entire thing,
mm-hmm.
and the time wasn't right. And eventually, when the time was right, they did make amends, and so that was good to see. I think that Sean, going back to the point, you know, does he have plausible deniability? Has he moved on? Did he forget that he was actually involved in it? You know, maybe a little bit of all three. But I think mainly he's ready to move on. He moved on a long time ago. And I think that was probably the biggest factor of all.
I agree. I agree 100% with that sentiment.
Yeah, right, I think so,
let's go to the match itself.
But your fandom of Scott, your fandom of Triple H is sickening.
Yes.
Go walk around the school. Go walk around Kowalski's school and try to, you know, sniff the air and see if you can still scent in there.
He's not even the greatest Kowalski graduate. That would be John Walters. It would be the greatest Kowalski graduate.
Oh, my God. I thought it was China. No. Never mind. Another day, Kev. We will.
We're going to have the great Triple H debate podcast.
JR's trying every possible way to get a new co-host, and every person says, you know, he likes Triple H, ha ha ha, and then they just...
Well, that should tell you something, that everyone can't stand him, so I don't know, just you.
I don't know. Well, when you have a favorite guy, you have a favorite guy, whatever. They drive their own bus with their kids in it. I don't know what the hell you want from me. I like his matches, whatever. All right.
He likes Kobe Bryant, too. He did that. I just hate assholes.
Oh, God.
All right, Kev, so let's get to the match itself now. Yeah. Reaction backstage as it's happening, as everything unwinds, personally, and just, you know, everyone else around you.
So we're watching this, you know, our little AOL area kind of in our, I guess, what was the TV locker room was sort of directly across from the curtain, from one of the curtains, if memory serves me correctly, because so finish happens, sharpshooter, Hebner calls for the bell, and then everything ensues. I remember just getting up out of my chair, just like, what? Oh, my gosh. First thing I said was, oh, what a great finish. Oh, it's fantastic. They found a way to get the belt off Brett and leave him strong. It's amazing. They screwed him over. I love it. And everybody was like, that wasn't supposed to be the finish. What do you mean? That was great. It was brilliant. And, so then we start to watch, you know, there's Vince and everybody, you know, and Brett spits on him and he's tearing up the monitors and, oh boy. And then, it's starting to sink into old dummy here that, yeah, this wasn't part of the plan. And so then I remember seeing Earl Hebner run out like he had just, you know, robbed a bank.
Basically did.
The car was parked running. Dave Hebner was in the driver's seat. Earl jumped in. His bag was already in the car. Seriously, they jumped in, drove away. Hebner's stealing off like thieves of the night.
I think they did the same thing after they screwed Hulk Hogan against Andre the Giant and Ted DiBiase back in 1988.
Exactly. They're driving to Ottawa, drinking beer, you know?
A track record.
Yep.
So anyway, that was the first thing. Like, well, that was kind of weird. And then Lawler comes through the curtain. And Jerry just kind of looks at me and just rolls his eyes like, ugh, What a bunch of stupid. I go, you know, I just shrugged my shoulders like, what do I know? And then I followed the, you know, I was kind of behind the camera that was shooting that Brett documentary.
Yep.
And I may have said this last time, as they were coming down the hall and, you know, had the bird's eye view, the same view that the viewer of the film saw. And being able to see, you know, as they all walked in the locker room, and there was Julie screaming at Triple H and Carl DeMarco and his 17-foot head, you know, the head of WWF Canada. You could land planes on his head.
Very androgynous looking.
Oh, my. Well, that was, again, how did he become the head of WWF Canada? He started off as the limo driver who picked up Brett.
Oh,
that was how his career began. So,
oh,
and he was really, you know, seeing the end of his time, because it wasn't too long after that he was gone too.
Right.
But it was it was just surreal. And then, of course, you know, we didn't hear any of the commotion in the locker room. The next thing we see is Vince walking out, stumbling, you know, and he always had that awkward gait anyway. Well, now it was worse, because after Brett punched him, Briscoe jumped over to save him and stepped on his foot. So
typical stooge.
Yep. And so that was entertaining after the fact, not so much then. And then we went and kind of did like an awkward recap and said goodnight quickly and got out of there.
Were you as frightened of Julie as it seemed like everyone else was during that moment?
That was a big woman, let me tell you something.
Oh my God. Oh,
there was a bunch of crazy hearts all over that. And anytime you went to Canada,
yep.
You know, there were a lot of Hart family members around.
Oh, yeah.
And it was, you know, Brett's kids kind of ran amok. Owen's kids were always so well-behaved. I mean, they were a lot smaller, but they were very, very polite, very well-behaved. And Brett's kids ran around like wild Indians. So it was, you know, it was always chaotic, and there was always a lot of them there. And
right.
So we were kind of walking with our backs against the wall. We didn't want to get blamed for anything. So,
jeez.
But then, as fate would have it, I didn't go to Raw the next day. I flew back to New York and then went to the office. Then heard about all the fallout, you know, all the fallout with guys not going to Raw.
Mm-hmm.
Mick Foley and I think the Road Warriors and a few others were like, oh, you guys screwed Brett over. Forget it. We're protesting by not going to work. So. And I think they talk everybody into coming back, and they had a big meeting about it, or did they leave after the meeting? I can't remember. I thought that was like kind of, you know, Bush League.
People walking out.
Yeah, give me a break.
Yeah, I mean, where are they going to go? I think they realize that. I think it's even in Foley's book. He talks about how Brett kind of talked to Brett, and Brett told him to stay and go back to work because, it's, you know, what are you going to do? And not everyone can leave and go get gigs in WCW for, you know, $3 million a year or whatever. So I agree with you. I thought it was kind of, you know.
They were upset, and they reacted. They reacted what they felt like was appropriately.
Was anyone else close to leaving? Like, I know, I think Brian Adams ended up leaving, and Rude, obviously, we know, ended up leaving. Bulldog and Anvil left, and Owen tried to leave. That's the story anyway. Do you think they should have just let Owen go? I mean, obviously, with hindsight, yes, we all wish they let him go. But do you think, you know, they should have, or do you think Vince was right in holding him to his contract?
I think Vince was right in holding him to his contract, because I think he did it not – I think he did it for Owen's own good. I think the plan was to really push Owen after the fact, and that Owen would have been, you know, up there. There were a couple of the factors, of course, Austin's injury. And then he became another guy that would never work with. So there was always that. And I think the belief was that by Owen staying, you know, he's out of Brett's shadow and he can do his own thing and be his own man. He's going to make a lot of money, and, you know, better to do that than to go to some place like CW, where the belief was amongst a lot of people that this really was just a money grab for a lot of guys.
Right.
And then it was not going to be sustainable. That's why so many guys went there and just didn't even try, because they were like, this is a joke. You know, you can't spend this kind of money and act this way and expect it to last forever. Everybody had seen this before. So they went down there and they were like, oh, this is a bunch of money marks. And they showed up drunk and whenever they felt like it and did whatever they wanted to do and made a joke of the place and stole money. And when it ran out of money, they all left.
Yep.
So
we talked about Earl before, Kevin, and a lot of people consider him collateral damage in this whole thing. You know, he was kind of the poor guy in the middle that had to do what he was told, even though he probably didn't believe it. Obviously, you worked with Earl and talked with Earl. What was his thoughts about the whole day and being caught in the middle of this whole storm? What was his thinking about this? Because he was like the soldier that just had to do his thing, and then he had a book. So what was his thinking that day?
We played cards with Earl a number of times. It didn't really, you know. So Earl, as we're sitting here playing cards and relaxing, tell us about Montreal. You know, it was more like, you know, little comments in passing. I think it always bothered him to a certain extent that he had to do that, but he had to do it, and that was his job. And so I think it's a whole flood of emotions. Earl and Dave, very emotional guys, very caring, passionate guys who really love wrestling and love the guys that they work with and have great respect for the people, you know, that run the companies that they do. And so that was one thing that I always got from Earl. Love Earl, great person. So is Dave. And but I think it always bothered him, you know. And now he's kind of made money off of it too. Like, oh, I screwed Brett. He sells T-shirts at TNA shows.
Still cashing in.
Why not, man? 17 years later, they're still making money off of this gimmick. So,
greatest. If it wasn't work, it's the greatest work angle of all time. But
it's tremendous. It's tremendous. If it was, then yes, it was the greatest of all time.
Hey, Kevin. Sidebar. You keep mentioning the AOL thing. I first went online in like May of '96. So I was big into the AOL site. Do I have you to thank for all the pictures of Sonny that got me through the ages of 15 through 17 on the AOL site?
That was Jim Monsees.
Okay.
Jim Monsees was the head of the AOL group, and he was actually a friend of Vince Russo's going back to high school, I think.
Oh, wow.
And so Jimmy needed a job. They'd worked together. And he had some, again, what were we? It wasn't exactly like, you know, anybody had knowledge of, had basic knowledge of computers. You could figure out AOL.
Right.
And how to upload things and how to keep things moving and understood how to tell a story and understood, you know, the man side of it, managing the content. So he did a very good job of seeing the opportunities and then, you know, the infancy of WWF.com.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that was him who did. He relieved a lot of tension for you back then, huh?
Oh, big Sonny fan. And, I like the theme songs as well that they post.
Big Sonny. You're a big Sonny fan now?
No, I was when I was 16.
How about, you know, are you one of the guys, are you bailing her out now?
Yes, wiring money to her secretly. Thank you for blowing my spot up. I appreciate it.
Let me ask you a question. What in the world, other than probably just enormous sexual prowess, does that guy have that would make this woman continue to go back time and time and time again and violate restraining order after restraining order and get arrested, rearrested, and arrested again? What is it?
Drugs? Powerful thing.
Is it hypnosis? What is this? Has he got some kind of spell on her? What the hell is it?
Daddy issues. Serious daddy issues.
Oh, God. What a mess.
Yeah. It's a shame because when she was at the Raw 15 episode, I thought she was back for good. She got a great pop from the crowd, and I really thought she was going to stick around. And unfortunately, she went back downhill.
Do you think they wasted a chance with her, Kevin? I mean, she you know, was used pretty heavily in her first year as a manager and everything, and then it seemed like by like '97 she was just kind of aimless. Do you think they could have used her better, or do you think it was doomed from the start?
Well, she could have not been used better. She could have used herself better. Let's say backstage.
Mm-hmm.
Why do so many divas come and go so quickly in the WWF and now the WWE? It's because for whatever reason, they find the need to hook up with guys backstage and become their real life girlfriend. And it never winds up well. So she's sleeping with Brett. She's sleeping with Sean. She's doing Davey. She's doing this one. She's doing that one. Who knows? Who cares? But it looks bad upon the girl. it makes the girl look bad. For a guy, it's the old, you know, the old adage, a guy is a stud, a girl is a whore.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, that's it again. It becomes, it's a matter of perception. And so, yeah, what are they going to use her as? They perceived her, again, WWF, WWE is a fishbowl. And Vince McMahon is the biggest fan there is, the biggest mark that there is, and he only sees the people that he pays how the viewer at home sees them, right? And but he sees all – he knows all the other stuff too. So then he projects all that other stuff into the eyes of the fan, in his own eyes. It's complex, but trust me on this. It's a fishbowl, and he sees all of them as talent.
Mm-hmm.
And he only saw Sonny as Sonny, but he knew at the same time that she was sleep around Sally. And so there was it was perception issues. And I think that's one of the reasons why she hit the ceiling as quickly as she did, because there was a belief that she was not trustworthy, not, you know, all these different things, because look at how she conducted herself away from the ring and then got into drugs and was a mess. So,
yep. Downhill from there. Sad.
But when she was there in 95, 96, holy cow. Man, I mean, the stories that the guys would tell just about, like, staring at her.
Yeah.
Not even doing anything with her, but just like, oh, my gosh. She was sitting on the couch. Man, oh, man. Like, yeah, she's a gorgeous girl. Mm. No, you don't understand.
Yeah.
I don't know. So, yeah, there was nobody hotter at that time. No doubt about it.
It was quite the source of pride at that age of 15 when I realized she and I shared the same birthday. That was like, I feel like we had some weird connection back then.
And you do to this day every time you go down there and bail her out.
That's right. I say, come on, we get the same birthday. Me, you, and Larry Bird, we all get the same birthday.
Oh, God.
All right. Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
All right, so one guy that in this whole storm that is now swirling Montreal in the next night, one guy that I was always curious about what he thought of this whole thing was The Undertaker, because he's pretty much at this point maybe the elder statesman already, and he's only been there, what, 7 years at that point, the most respected guy in the room. What was his take on this whole thing? Did you know? Did he make it clear? Obviously, I don't know if he's soft-spoken or if he's vocal. What was his thinking at this point,
being
the top guy in the room?
I never spoke to him about it. But I knew that, and having heard from so many people, there were two examples where, you know, I don't think The Undertaker liked Shawn Michaels very much. The first was the night of the Click send off at the Garden. Apparently Davey and Taker were basically had to be restrained going out there, killing everyone. And then the second example was when Austin beat Shawn for the belt in 98 at WrestleMania.
Oh, you got to tell me what I think you're going to tell me? Oh,
what,
boy.
That Taker was at Gorilla?
We were just talking about it. We just posted our WrestleMania 14 podcast, and the two urban legends that now hopefully you can tell us whether they are true or false. The first one, apparently, Shawn was harping and chirping backstage saying he wasn't going to do it. Stone Cold wasn't ready. I'm not turning the belt over. He's not. And Taker was just sitting there taping his fists and kind of looking at him like, the fuck, you're not.
I don't think that – I don't think that was the case.
Okay.
That one
I – that was about 50-50.
That one I'll debunk.
Okay.
Because Shawn was cordoned off in his own dressing room the whole day.
Okay.
The only person that he had contact with really was Hunter in China.
Okay.
And I guess Pat – Patterson went back and forth a few times, and then that was it. But Taker was definitely at Gorilla.
Okay.
May have been there to watch the match. May have been also to make sure that there was no nonsense.
Yeah. Apparently the quote was, and I believe this, I'm not sure where this came from, but apparently the quote was, if he doesn't drop the strap, I'm dropping him.
Yeah, that's probably what he said.
Okay.
That makes sense. That one I can confirm.
Okay. That's pretty much what we said on our podcast the other night, that the gorilla position one was a sure thing, and the one in the locker room was iffy at best.
Right. Okay. Now, that may have been something that was said not even directly to one another. It may have been said indirectly, just in case there's thought of anything going on tonight, just remember. you know, right. as he's sitting there taping his fists.
Right.
So, yes, very. So I always thought that, well, I think Taker understood the business side of it. Brett may have dropped a couple of points in his book for not wanting to do business the right way on the way out the door.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he was a fan of Sean. So, and I think he liked, I know he liked Steve a lot. And he's got along with Austin very well. So I think that that was, that's why when I saw Sean and Hunter and Taker, you know, slowly limping up the ramp at last year's WrestleMania, I was like, boy, you know, nothing like a few years and a whole lot of money to make, you know, to make a guy forget about how much he hates your guts.
Right.
Because that was the perfect example right there. Because he hated both of them. Especially Sean.
Well, then there was, of course, the other story. I know we're kind of going on, but pertaining to the whole Sean Taker thing, just looking ahead, the other urban legend story right before WrestleMania 17, when Sean was supposed to do something at that WrestleMania, but showed up at a Raw all screwed up, and it's actually it's true because it's on the Sean DVD, and Taker pretty much said, just get him out of my face. That was the other story that was on, I think it's on the Sean DVD. So, yeah, and suddenly what? 8 years later, they have five-star matches at WrestleMania, and everything's all fine and dandy. Maybe Sean apologized in his new spiritual way of thinking, but...
Well, you know, I did a lot of messed up things back then, and, you know...
Tell you! So Taker, so pretty much from what we've gathered, Kevin, Taker pretty much was just disgusted by the whole thing.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think he was arrogant, but I think there's a part of him, as in all of us, there's a morbid curiosity to watch people self-destruct, and that sort of, not self-destruct, but to watch this, you know, to watch the car crash unfold. We all want to see it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you can't protect people from themselves a lot of times. So I think he wanted to be there to make sure, you know, that things went down the right way, but it was more of like, I'm kind of curious too. Let's see how this works out. You know, it wasn't like, you know, Taker was the locker room leader who didn't enjoy a good bit of locker room gossip too, and a good bit of ribbitry. So that was, you know, he was the judge of wrestler's court. So, I mean, he was there for all the fun stuff too. So I think there was a part of it that was kind of like, ooh, I want to see how this turns out, you know, monitor sellout sort of thing.
So Kevin, as a fan coming off Montreal, looking at the scene, the whole promotion felt very, I don't say dead, but very just dark. Flat. And it felt like they were going out of business to a 16-year-old diehard fan at the time. You know, Brett was going to WCW, and it felt like WCW was just poaching everyone. And then there were rumors that Undertaker was leaving. I doubt they were ever even true, but that was the word out on the hotlines and the newsletters and everything that Taker was leaving. And I went to a house show in Providence in December, and Taker no-showed. I don't know if it was a real no-show or storyline no-show. And we took that as guarantee. Okay, Taker's leaving, and this is it. WWF's going out of business. I mean, did that feel like that way on the inside, or did it feel when Brett left that things loosened up a little bit and that the attitude thing was really going to take off?
The only time it felt like we had turned the corner and started to move past it was when Vince did his interview, which was when?
I think it was like 2 weeks later.
2 weeks later, yeah.
that next night, ugh, and the following week after that, ugh. And then, you know, as we finally heard Vince and saw him in the camel hair jacket with the black eye, that was what we needed to hear. And then from there, we knew we were all right. We knew we were cool. But, yeah, it took some time. I don't know where that whole Taker thing came from. I don't know if that was – I don't remember that ever being the case.
Yeah, I doubt it. I doubt it was. It was probably just one of those – you know, there were a million hotlines out there at the time in 97, 96, 97. Basically, they would just take shit from the Observer and say it to you on their hotline. So I doubt it was anything. Yeah. It was probably just, you know, Undertaker was pissed kind of stuff, and they probably ran with it saying, well, he could be leaving. This is the same hotlines that had Demolition returning every week in 97, 98. So –
Demolition.
Greatest tag team ever, man. So that that time period, I agree with you that I think externally it felt a little bit longer. So you say it was a couple weeks, or I think as a fan it was maybe into the new year when the promotion started to seem kind of awake again with the whole Austin kind of getting ramped back up and Rock kind of, you know, taking foothold and all the Tyson stuff.
But we had to get through the you know, Ken Shamrock pay-per-view.
Right, and that's where I was headed next.
Yes.
Weird, very weird feeling at that choice. Was Shamrock a good choice or what's your thoughts on that whole pay-per-view?
I thought it was the perfect choice. It was the exact right time to do something with Kenny. When else are you going to do it? And who else are you going to do it with at the time? He was a perfect guy. And I felt like it was a well-built show.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I thought it was constructed really nicely. And I thought it had a good beginning, middle, and end. And it had the right outcome. So that was it. Not everybody who's a contender becomes the champion.
Right. No, yeah, I wouldn't think he should have gotten the belt there at all. I mean, I think he was a good challenger. I agree with you. It was a good time to use him. Do you feel like Sean tried to make him look stupid at times, though? I mean, there was the whole thing on Raw where he was, like, calling the spots out loud and a couple other times where he was kind of either overselling or underselling for him. And it seemed like a little bit he was fucking with him.
I think Sean was just in asshole mode most of the time.
Yeah.
The time where Shamrock had him in the ankle lock and he was chewing the gum.
He was sucking on the lollipop.
It was. Yeah. You know.
Yeah, just basic a-hole stuff.
Yeah. The use of Sergeant Slaughter, Commissioner Slaughter, in a match there, was that just lack of depth, or it seemed like a very thin roster at that point before things kind of reloaded in 98. You know, what was the thought using getting him back into action?
I think it was, again, he was the commissioner at the time and was, you know, running afoul of these hooligans. And so what else are you going to do? Boot camp match. Why not? Yep. Makes perfect sense.
It was a good match, too. A good comeback for Slaughter.
Yeah, Slaughter was great in it. So it was exactly what it should have been. I didn't have a lot of problems with much of anything, you know, because we had come off of, you know, we were just building towards a lot of stuff in the new year, you know, so it felt like things were going to be pretty exciting in 98.
When Kevin, you talked about the well-known camel-haired blazer interview. When do you think at some point Vince said to himself, you know, I think I might have a good character coming here. You know, this Brett thing is nice, but I could lead this into something else and into something else. When do you think that moment when Vince said, I could be a bad guy? When do you think that moment came?
When he was a kid.
It's true, yes.
And he admired Dr. Jerry Graham, and his father smartly said to him, don't hang out with him and don't be anywhere near the business and go sell soft drinks or something. Go do something else. He always wanted to be it. And it was just, again, it's his showman that's in him. That's who he is. You know, we saw a little bit of in the, with the Slammies and the, you know, mid-80s. Come on.
Yep.
It was funny how things progressed, because each thing along the way, you saw Vince start to do more and more, like, you know, as Vince and I cut the promo, you know, I'm interviewing him in the ring about the match, Austin versus Michaels, who's going to win, what do you think, you know, well, I think it's going to be a great wrestling match, come on, you know, listen, listen, Vince, hold it. You're telling us without telling us here. So what's the answer? Yes or no? It's not just no, it's hell no.
Yep.
That was great.
Awesome.
So yeah, each one of those little things, you know, like how Vince wrestles against Austin after he wins the belt, you know, that was,
you think he's the greatest heel character in the company history?
Oh, beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Right. Easily.
There's no comparison.
Yeah.
He's the greatest performer ever. He went out to, and I love this story. It's my favorite story about Vince. We're at Nassau Coliseum, and he's going out to cut a promo about Stone Cold. It was like the go-home week of a pay-per-view or whatever it was. And he goes out to the ring, goes in the center of the ring, cuts the promo. That was it. Leaves, comes back, walks back through Gorilla, and he starts laughing. And he's like, you're never going to believe this. What? I shit myself. Apparently, before he went out to cut the promo, he's standing there waiting for his music to hit. He farts and, dro- and draws mud.
What the fuck?
Not just a little, a whole lot.
Oh, my Lord.
So he goes down the ramp. He gets in the ring, squishing in his shoes and everything, cuts the promo, doesn't miss a beat, walks back through, shit all down the back of his legs in his shoes. So he sends somebody to go get his – he's got to get changed, right? He's got to – so.
Oh, my God.
Flash forward now like an hour.
Oh, God.
And we're backstage, and I hear all this commotion. And running past me goes Jerry Briscoe, holding his face like he's trying not to throw up. Chasing behind him is Vince McMahon, now wearing sweat clothes with shit-stained underwear on the end of a piece of camera equipment. Come here, Briscoe! Ha, ha, ha! And chasing him down the hallway as Briscoe's trying to...
This guy, you all right?
Vince is shitty drawers on the end of this stick.
Oh, God. JR, you got to add this to the Duggan reports.
Oh, my Lord. Jesus. That's an awesome
greatest story.
Take
ever.
A whiff, Briscoe!
That is awesome.
Was.
Oh, man.
That's like, oh, God.
That's like Opie and Anthony's impression of Vince, you know, which I love when Anthony does that. When he's talking about when he does the Vince impression and like when Lawler had the heart attack, you know, get him up, get him back in the chair. I don't care if he's bleeding out of his eyes, you know, it's hurting on Vince, but Vince is like, everybody used to give him, you know, gives him such grief for his ego and all this and that. He's really like a kind of a goofy, fun loving guy.
Yeah, that's always the feel I got, honestly.
He may have changed a lot over the years because, again, I've been gone from there longer than I worked there. But when I knew him, when I saw him, he was always like – he was like a big kid and had just a very juvenile sense of humor that was a lot of fun. Now, he serious down to business. He knew when it was time to work. But then after that, man, he could cut up and it was always enjoyable.
I think you had to be to be as humiliated as he's been on TV and take the shit he's taken. You know, he gives a lot, but he always gets his, you know, comeuppance in the end. And the way he does it is always epic. So, I mean, you got to figure he's pretty, like you said, just kind of a laid back, fun loving guy to go through the shit he goes through on TV when he doesn't need to at all.
He's not, I would never say he's laid back because he never takes.
Right. Never
takes a day off. He never stops thinking about it, which is scary to think about. Because I sat on my ass for 4 days this past week, and I didn't do a damn thing. I didn't think about anything. I just watched football and ate turkey leftovers. So I imagine Vince doing that for he's where he is. Maybe we can learn a lesson from that. Scott, maybe you could take a page out of that. Start to put some real work ethic behind what you do.
That's right. I agree.
I think he's upset.
Vince is – I don't know if I really want to get into this, but, of course, there's a lot of rumors out there about habits and different things. I mean, you ever see any of that, or is it blown out of proportion?
Well, what are some of the habits? What are some of the things you've heard?
Basically, Coke habit. Bad Coke.
Oh, God,
habit.
I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I don't know. I figured I'd throw it out there.
No, I never heard any of that. I never saw any of it. I know that he always hated seeing sick. And said to Vince Russo, there is no sick. Vince Russo was sick as a dog one time, and he basically told him, there is no sick.
Yep.
So that was pretty much it. But as far as the rest of the stuff, I don't know.
Yeah, I figured.
You think
believe me, I wasn't in the inner circle at all.
Is he there until he dies?
Oh my God, they're gonna peel the pencil out of his cold dead hand.
Yeah. That's right. I think he wants to do it in the ring.
I think that's the way a lot of guys, that'd be fine with me. I said in another interview show, if I ever drop dead at the announce position, the top heel in the promotion has my permission to drag my lifeless corpse into the ring and drop elbows on it.
So you were fine with the punk stuff, right? Jerry Lawler then?
Oh, my God, yes.
Yeah, I knew you would be.
I thought it was great. The only thing I didn't like was that I felt like the WWE was sort of putting themselves over with that timeline video.
Yes.
Oh, look how great we were. And the inference was, look how great we were and that we were able to rush him to safety because everything had the WWE logo on it.
Right.
You know, 9/17, Lawler falls out of chair. 9:18, we're there on the scene, helping him. 9:20, oh.
Break.
You know, stop putting yourself over all the time. And it was also cover your ass, too, in case any Lawler ever wanted to sue.
Right, that's definitely why they had it. Because everyone was like, why were they filming it? Well, that was clearly why. They had it all filmed in case, you know, anything ever happened. They could show what they did.
But, you know, but again, I guess when you're paranoid like that, that's what you have to be. So, but then to turn around, it's one thing to have it in the vault.
Right.
And just, but it's another to put yourself over on TV and say, look how great we are.
Yep.
So that's the one thing that always bugs me is how the brand puts itself over all the time. They can't get anybody over. They can't get anybody over to save their lives, but they can get the brand over. They bend themselves twist themselves into pretzels trying to get the brand over, but don't spend 2 seconds of thought on getting anybody else over.
That is a problem right now. That's exactly right.
Well, that kind of segues nicely to my next question, going back to 97. The tale of Scott's favorite tag team, the New Age Outlaws. Well, second favorite tag team.
Behind Demolition?
No, behind the Road Warriors are his favorite.
The Road Warriors were my favorite tag team. Or were they assholes too?
No.
You're going to crush my hopes and dreams again?
Oh, they were awesome guys.
Okay, good.
Oh, I loved them to death. They were fantastic.
You think they used them properly throughout 97? Because I argue that they did. I feel like they used them perfectly to help, you know, put over other teams and, you know, legacy or not.
Yeah, I think so. I think they used them the right way. Absolutely. And no regrets. It was a different era. Tag team wrestling wasn't what it was, you know. But yeah, I thought that they did very well with them.
And one of the teams they put over greatly was the New Age Outlaws many times. So, did you think this thing was ever going to take off like it did when they put these two guys together in November?
When they first cut the promo. Because when they put them together in that, it was like a shotgun match or something like that, tag, I was one of the ones who was there at the monitor. And I didn't go telling anybody other than Kip. And I told him kind of after the fact, you know, because I was friends with Billy Gunn for years. Man, there is something there with you guys. There is a chemistry there. There is something there. And I wasn't the only one that said it, which is why they put them together. And, you know, so then when it was, you know, Roadie coming out saying, I smell money, that was the belief. Those two guys together with money.
Yep.
And they were money. And DX glommed the Outlaws to capitalize, you know, to steal their heat. Because the Outlaws were getting over bigger than Sean and Hunter.
And I give the, you know, Russo and those guys credit for sticking with it. And, you know, it's something you don't see today is the way they stuck with them and really pushed them and ran with them. I mean, it was unbelievable at the time to say, oh, my God, they put these two guys together and they're winning. You know, they put them over. They put them over the Road Warriors. And at the time, you're thinking, all right, they're going to hold the belts for a few weeks and the Road Warriors will win it back. And that'll be that. But, you know, they just kept trucking along. And before you know it, they're shoving, you know, Mick Foley and Terry Funk off a stage and everything else. And it was crazy to just see how quickly they ramped them up. You know, from two job boys to up to, you know, a main event level tag team.
And that's the example that you can still use today. It doesn't matter what you were. It matters what you are.
Yep.
And if you're positioned the right way and pushed the right way, anybody can get over. They can fix Dolph Ziggler tomorrow and they could make him a credible world champion. They just have to change his name.
Yes.
And then stop beating him and allow him to start to get over. And he'll be over. 6 months, he'll be over. And next year's WrestleMania, he'll be able to be in the main event and win the belt from whoever the champion is at the time.
Triple
and
H.
Be the number one guy in the industry. But Triple H Jr. Did you want to name, Scott, did you want to name, change your name at some point to Triple H?
You know, I never, that's interesting.
Well, you know, he walks out of his bathroom every morning and spits the water into the sky and
I
everything
do.
Else. He emulates
yes,
the
I
exact
do.
Entrance.
And the family's like, what a mess. What are you doing?
Yes. I do have my own Terror Rising robe. So that's okay. I do walk around with a purple terror. No. What did you think of the – as the year was ending and 98 was starting,
Let me ask you a question before this. Did you cry watching a Beautiful Day video with U2? Did you remember that one?
Oh, are you kidding me? I played it. Over and over again, forever. That was one of my. It's my favorite moment in the history of Raw. Was that January 7th, 2002, when he walked out of the.
Kevin, none of this is hyperbole, my friend. This is all legit. We are not making any of this up.
That's awesome. He remembers the date.
Of course he
does. January 7th, 2002. Of course.
Oh, Jesus.
Okay. All right, but so actually, I will say this, though. In all seriousness, and this is no joke that JR knows, Triple H is not my favorite of all time. He's my favorite. He's one of my two or three favorites. My favorite of all time is Ric Flair. So just,
okay.
So I just want to make that clear. I have enough Triple H stuff, but the Road Warriors are my favorite tag team of all time. All right. So the roster in 97, as you get into the end after the defections, with all those guys there that were, you know, as JR and I did, we did a podcast of the DX pay-per-view, and we both said that the roster seemed a little kind of disjointed, kind of thin. However, of all of the muck that was kind of moving around at the end of the year, two jewels shine bright for the future. And that is, of course, Stone Cold and The Rock. Now, standalone, they were obviously growing by leaps and bounds. Austin had already reached, we already knew what he was going to do. But over the last few months, particularly when Rock joined the Nation, and JR and I have talked about this in our last few vaults, he was just jumping on the train. He got it, you know, being a Miami alum. I've said this many times. I think being a Hurricane alum, he had that swagger that, you know, I went to the U, and I think he used that as part of his personality. At least at that point, you see Rock and Austin together. Did everybody start thinking, I think we have a pair here to lead us into the future?
Oh yeah. I think that was very, very apparent. And was I think it was talked about even when before he became when he was Rocky Maivia, the belief was that he and Austin would main event someday. When he became The Rock, they knew they had just two absolute behemoths who they could put on these inevitable collision courses, and it would never stop drawing money. And it never has, and it never will. Nope. It's incredible. Never happened before. Probably will never happen again, where you have two stars of that magnitude and that big of a stage with that many people watching the product and each and every week, with the wrestling business at its absolute hottest, drawing more money, selling more merchandise than any other time in its history. What they thought was going to be great, they never imagined how big it would have become.
And the feud started great too, with the whole, you know, Rock slowly getting ramped up as a heel and Vince slowly starting to turn, you know, and kind of almost not really aligning with The Rock, but kind of aligning with him, and the whole throwing the belt in the river and Austin knocking Vince off the ring and all that stuff. It really just turned the mood. Everything felt so dead and dark, and then all of a sudden you got these two guys going out there and just killing it, and you couldn't help but get fired up again.
Right, and that was again the part of the future, and you know that Austin had bigger fish to fry. He was going after the world title, you know, WWF title, and it's like, wow, man, Rock's coming right up behind you.
Yep.
So watch out, because it's going to be great. And it, you know, and I'd love that time period too, because I started to see, you know, you start to see how everything is kind of unfolding, and the guys that you really like, you know, I was friends with Rock, I was friends with Billy Gunn, you know, I was glad to see those guys starting to really get over, and they knew it and they felt it, and everybody started to believe it. It took really until like May of 99 that the war was over.
Right.
But, you know, so here we were in December of 97. And it was like, wow, things are really starting to percolate here. This is going to be very, very good. And I was sort of torn because I liked Vince Russo a lot, but I also liked Jim Cornette a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And the two of them were exact opposites, and the two of them cut the exact same opposite promo to me, you know, kind of as confidants, I guess you could say. And, you know, so I would always just listen to each side. That was the end of it. You know, neither could stand the other, and both had 180 degree opposite opinions about what the wrestling industry was, could be, should be, and each other's viewpoints. So it was always, I was always torn, but I could see that Russo's beliefs were working at this time, because they were, and you can't argue with it. And there were folks that were reining him in. And, you know, when you had great guys like Pat Patterson and Bruce Pritchard and Kevin Dunn and Jim Cornette and the other agents and Vince McMahon, of course, you know, all sort of helping to bring these ideas along, and not just have them, you know, it's like, okay, you take a baby and you raise the baby right, and eventually he's going to grow up and become a mature adult. Or you could take the baby and you could just let him run amok in the streets with no diaper. The kid's going to grow up, but he's going to be an animal. He's going to be out of control. That's Russo, you know. And the others, thank God the others were there to kind of raise the baby. Otherwise, you know, the kid would have been a psychopath.
One of Bret Hart's kids running around.
Oh, those kids were animals. Top five greatest tag teams. Top five greatest tag teams of all time. All right. Any year of any time. The most influential teams. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
In no particular order. Here we go. Number five, the Road Warriors. No particular order.
Yep.
Freebirds. Rock and Roll Express. Midnight Express.
I concur.
And
Twin Towers.
Please.
I think I might be missing one. Not the Twin Towers.
Okay.
Let me think.
Our Foundation.
Tully and Arn.
Brainbusters. Impressive.
I'm going to go with that.
Okay.
You have the Rockers on the outside looking in?
Yeah, only because I always made that list like before. I had made that list before the Rockers.
Yep.
Okay. They certainly were, you know, you might have to take, but you can't, how do you not have any of those five? I mean, the Freebirds brought rock and roll music into it.
Mm-hmm.
And what the Rock and Roll Express and the Midnight Express did, you know, was like just beautiful music. And Road Warriors with their power and everything that they did, and Tully and Arn with just the heat and everything they were able to generate. Yes. I think the Rock and Roll Express were kind of, you know, the Rockers followed that Rock and Roll Express. So that's what I'm saying, influential. The Rock and Roll Express get the points as far as being influential, albeit that a lot of teams over the years have copied the Rockers.
Right.
They were inspired by the Rock and Roll Express.
Let me ask you, Kevin, while we're on the subject of tag teams quick before we head back to '97. 10 to 15 years from now, when people will talk about the greatest tag teams of the last 20 years, one team that you pay attention to and see often now are the Briscoes. Would you put them on a list 15 years from now, 10 years from now?
It's going to be hard. I'm going to make it. It's kind of a selfish prediction. Mm-hmm. But I think that if ROH is ever able to get to the level of national prominence in the United States that I think they're going to become, that it's going to be because of the Briscoes. I think that they can transcend the brand. They almost do to this point. They can do no wrong. And I think they're really figuring it out, that they are ambassadors for the brand. I think that Mark and Jay's influence over Ring of Honor is bigger than wins and losses. That it's their presence on the show, and it's what they mean in the locker room, and what they mean to the fans. Really is like they truly are the heart and soul of Ring of Honor. So they will be, you know, first ballot Hall of Famers. I've always talked about this, you know, with Ring of Honor, they are, beyond a shadow of a doubt, they're on the first ballot. They're in the first class of inductees, among others, but they are in that first class and mean more to, I think they mean as much to Ring of Honor fans in the old as Punk and Joe and Danielson did. And they mean everything to the current fan now in the wake of the departure of so many over the last 24 months. So, yeah, without the Briscoes, I think Ring of Honor would be in a lot of trouble. Thank God we don't have to worry about that. So, but that's it's a pleasure to work with them and to have them and to see them as long as I've known them, you know, since they were teenagers, and to see them now and as grown men figuring it out. So it's really wonderful.
Just quickly, Kev, while we're on the kind of favorites topic, just number one, not influential, not anything. Who's just your favorite single wrestler of all time?
Well, when I was a kid, it was Dusty Rhodes. But as I got older, it was Ric Flair. And it's still Ric Flair to this day.
Okay, yeah, I was going to say, the guy whose DVD of matches you would take if you could only, if you're going on a vacation, you can take one DVD with you and just watch this guy's matches.
Ric Flair.
Excellent.
Yeah, it would be Ric Flair. Only because, and part of it too is because those matches mean, you know, I would rather watch, if I had the choice of watching Ric Flair, Ricky Steamboat,
mm-hmm.
or the Rock and Roll Express, Midnight Express, I'd rather watch the Rock and Rolls and the Midnights.
Mm-hmm.
But not taking anything away from Flair and Steamboat. It's just that those shows in 85 to 87, that's what it meant to me. When I, at the peak of my fandom, my senior year of high school and my first 2 years of college, it didn't get any better to me than the Rock and Roll Express and the Midnight Express. So that's what I watch when I sit and play around on YouTube. That's what I look at. You know, I'll watch Ric Flair. Then Steamboat, I'll watch Rock and Rolls and the Midnights. I'll watch Dusty Rhodes promos, and that's about it, you know. And then some Botchamania, and then I go to bed. then I fake post as Scott on Triple H message board.
You'd have to have quite the level of love shown to have anyone believe it was him.
Oh God, I'm so used to it. All right, now, when we get to, as the clock is turning, there's still one moment in the wrestling business where the WWF could have been buried. And that was the, I guess, the one build that WCW didn't screw up.
Well, hang on, Scott. Before we get to that, I just want to ask one last, we'll wrap with that, but just one last WWF-based question, Kevin. The Christmas Raw, kind of an infamous one. They play it every year on 24/7. Right. You know, the one from Lowell where, you know, Shawn Michaels laid down for Triple H and Undertaker and Kane kind of had their first physical confrontation. Jim Cornette was actually on commentary. Austin stuns Santa Claus. And just any thoughts about that Raw in general? It's always kind of been one of my favorites to kind of throw in and watch.
It was kind of gross with them, you know, mooning the crowd.
Yep.
And that was a, you know, very much kind of like a Russo show. I remember Cornette being very grumpy at that time.
slightly.
About a lot of that. You know, again, it was, I think it had a little bit of everything for everybody. I think Ray Roy was Santa Claus, correct?
Ray Roy? Oh, my God. He was one of my favorite guys on only from, like, Rhode Island. He was... you know, we don't have that many guys coming out of here. So he was a big local guy. He was Pierre the Mountie was his name in the local promotion here. And he was like the champion forever. And whenever he'd pop up on like Superstars or something like that, we'd freak out because friggin' Ray Roy from Rhode Island is on Superstars. So go ahead. This is my side about Ray Roy.
I think he was the Santa Claus. And so he got the business there from Austin. So that was good. And it was, it just, you know, again, it was the first, I think I called the first hour. And then Ross and Lawler did the second. I think
it was Cornette the whole time. I thought.
Me, was it? I remember being on it.
Yeah, I think it was maybe you and Cornette. And
yeah,
then,
because I remember Cornette after the whole Triple H Shawn thing. He did the whole "We've been flim flam bamboozled."
Yeah, flip it out.
He does that whole strain of getting screwed over. We've been flim flam bamboozled. Okay.
Yeah.
Hoodwink. Yeah.
I think it was you and Cornette, and then Ross and Cornette did the second half.
Right. So yeah, that was kind of fun. fun time.
Yeah, it was always a
lull. Ugh.
Yeah. Well, never mind. I'm not going to go there. Scott's poster. Go ahead, Scott. Go where you're going.
Scott's poster. However, there was still one moment that WWF, I would assume, had to be a little trepidatious about, because the one feud or build that WCW actually did not screw up in their time was the build between Hogan and Sting. And then they had their match, the main event, Starrcade 97. Easily, had they done that right, you might have been done, if they got that right.
It did a huge buy rate. It did a huge buy rate.
Massive.
Yep.
Like a 1.8.
Yeah.
I don't remember. I think, again, there was more trepidation with Bash in the Beach and Hogan's turn, mm-hmm. because of where the company was at the time, than Sting Hogan with where the WWF was at the time. I think a lot of people felt like WWF was on the ascension, and that Starrcade was, that was another hurdle that we needed to overcome, but that we were on the rise, we were on the mend, and things were coming around. It was getting exciting again. And yeah, if they would have Nick Patrick, you know, supposedly doing the quick count, it's just Hogan's gamesmanship never ceased to amaze me. So.
You think they fucked Brett up right from the start?
Oh, my God, yes.
Right? Terrible.
Yeah. Inconceivable.
Awful.
I mean, I don't know how you botch that, him coming in with all that momentum and then doing what they did and just barely using him and just flip-flopping him back and forth as a face
again,
and heel.
Again, and what was the belief? Vince knew $3 million a year. Word gets out that Brett signed that kind of money contract. Are mm-hmm. you kidding me? In WCW? Whoo. That didn't sit well with the natives.
Right.
So Vince knew what he was doing.
I think
let's throw this nuclear bomb in the middle of it. Kaboom. They'll pay it. Ha ha, pal.
And I think that lends itself to the work theory as well. You know, all right, Brett, go cash in. You'll come back in 3 years. We'll do a huge angle. You and Sean, or you and me, whatever. I don't know. I go back and forth.
Well, then, of course, you forget that, like, Scott Hall and those guys had that deal where anybody comes in making more money than me, you've got to match. You've got to bump us up, because that's on the WCW DVD, that if somebody comes in that's making more money than us, I think him and Nash, you've got to either match it or make it higher than them. So mm-hmm. I'm sure Bischoff was probably like, ah, shit. I was hoping they wouldn't know. So there was no concern then that, oh my God, if this is done right, we could be in a lot of trouble and WCW could explode. So there wasn't as much concern as there was in that summer 96.
No, because again, I think the belief was, is that it's Hogan. His ego, not that he's not a draw, and not that him and Sting wouldn't draw, but that something's going to happen, that his ego would get the best of him. And it did. And that's, you know, am I correct here? What do you guys think?
Yeah. Oh, no, you're definitely right. Because he's the one who didn't, you know, had to have Brett come in and do the bell ringing and the whole nonsense. It should have just been Sting splashes him, puts the Scorpion Deathlock on, Hogan taps out, bang, done.
Well, see, I'm a little...
Well, everybody wanted.
I think it should have been a little bit more of a match. I don't know if it should have been that quick of a squash. I feel like you built this match for 18 months, and you go out there and have it be a minute. It may be a little much.
Oh, no, I'm not talking about a squash. No. But saying that's the ending should have been more clean.
No,
you
basically described it as squash, Scott. But
no, it's not. No,
he did.
Yes, he did. No, he...
No. See? Now you're just inventing drama, okay?
All right, whatever, Hunter. Calm down.
Oh, see?
All right, we'll see who's curtain jerking next week.
Another one I'm going to let go. Go ahead.
all right. It is an interesting question that's come up as we've talked about the whole Sean being a drugged up mess and all this other stuff. Do you think Kevin, at any point after Montreal, between Montreal and WrestleMania in Boston, that Vince, because Sean was such a pain in the ass, went, oh, maybe I fucked this up. Maybe I should have taken Brett's side.
It was always... There was kind of always that belief internally with a lot of folks. How much longer is he going to put up with this? And why does he always put up with Sean's nonsense? And what power does Sean have over Vince? Because no matter what Sean did, how badly he screwed up, somehow he was able to always wriggle off the hook and get Vince to love him again, no matter what it was. And so, yeah, there was kind of always that belief. So I don't know if Vince ever had that doubt. He probably would, you know, get mad and slam the door and say, you know, and then the two of them would start yelling and screaming. And then by the end of it, you know, basically Vince would be apologizing to Sean, it seemed like. But but they it was a strange relationship how Sean was always able to get his way with Vince. And then that finally ran out. That finally ran out when, I guess, Taker Hunter said, you need to go. You got to get. Because you can't be here like this anymore. So, yeah. So, did he pick the wrong guy? No, I think he always picked the right guy. I think he knew what he was doing.
You think Brett would have fought the attitude stuff? Do you think he knew he'd be a pain in the ass with where he wanted to go?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that that was, you know, that was a big part of it. And I don't know, again, I don't know why. I don't know what it was about Brett that Vince never saw that same level of thing. And I think there was always that desire for that level of acceptance from Brett, and that he seeked it out, you know, cause he never got it really with his own father, at the level that he wanted. And I think there was always that with Vince as well. He wanted that, that acceptance and that pat on the back that you're the guy, and he got it. But I always think he felt like he was underappreciated for everything he did for the company, carrying the ball when nobody else was there to carry it.
And it seemed like, you know, they'd always be in a rush to put it on someone else, and then they'd go crawling back to Brett in the end. It seemed like that happened a few times.
Oh, yeah. There was, you know, massive amounts of disrespect thrown Brett's way, or lack of appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the company could only draw, couldn't draw domestically, and could only draw in Europe. And Brett, for whatever reason, was their most popular star in Europe by leaps and bounds. And carried the brand, carried the flag everywhere that he went. And so they, you know, so they have to run these European tours to make some money and come back domestically, and everything was a struggle. And, you know, but the booking wasn't good. They just liked Brett over there, so they didn't care about the booking. You know, American fans cared about the booking, and there weren't great matchups for Brett outside of Owen.
Right. All right, so that pretty much wraps the year 97. I think we've hit every major star and topic possible over these past two podcasts. One follow-up, Kevin, I just want to bring up. A couple of listeners asked us to follow up. Last time you were on, you had some interesting comments about Vicky Guerrero and your feelings on her. You didn't really expound too much on them. You just kind of gave a quick hit on how you felt. If you don't want to get into it, we understand, but we just felt like we had to kind of ask for more info based on our listeners.
I don't know her personally, but my only experience with Vicky was that before Eddie died, when they were still married, apparently she cleaned all of his money out, stole everything from him, and then was portrayed as the grieving widow. You know, so I'm just saying that Eddie may not have been a saint, and their marriage may have had ups and downs and rocks, but she wasn't exactly perfect either. So I always thought that, you know, it was a little bit one-sided that she's painted as the, you know, tortured widow, when actually she was no angel at all. And that was just, again, Eddie was such a sweetheart and a prince to me, you know, and to a lot of people, that who's this douchebag woman, this wife of his, cleaning out all of his money and stealing everything from him? How dare she? You know, so that was always like my thing with Vicky. I hold no ill will towards her. I don't care. It wasn't my money.
Right.
But again, it was just it always was a bad taste in my mouth, and I didn't even know the woman. So that was it.
Okay.
That's really it. But again, they go out there and they portray her as a pig on TV, which does her no good and does no one any good.
Right.
So that's stupid in their own right.
I mean, for a while, you could argue a couple of years ago, she was the hottest heel they had. I mean, geez, the heat she was drawing.
Right. It just goes to show you how they don't know how to get over anybody over with any heat.
Right.
So there you go.
All right, Mr. Kevin Kelly, any Ring of Honor you want to plug for us?
Well, I invite everybody to join us for Final Battle. If you're anywhere in the New York City area, it's Sunday, December 16th, 2 p.m. bell time. Especially fans that are going to the WWE pay-per-view at the Barclays Center later that night, you'll have plenty of time to enjoy all of Final Battle and then head over to the show in Brooklyn. And fans that want to see it live anywhere in the world with internet access, go to ROHWrestling.com and you can order Final Battle Doomsday right now. The main event, Ladder War, Ring of Honor World Title, Kevin Steen defending against El Generico. The history between those two, of course, we could spend several podcasts just talking about that. That's going to be just, you know, the idea that these two guys getting together in the ring, once again, it always scares me whenever they wrestle one another. And now you put them in a ladder war. I have a bad feeling about it because I have two sons, and I know how I would feel watching my sons go into battle and to do something like that. And it just scares me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so anyway, that's Sunday, December 16th. And, there's a lot of great, Ring of Honor DVD releases out, a lot of great retrospectives, especially fans of CM Punk and Daniel Bryan and, some of the older class, older generation. You go on there, go to ROHWrestling.com, and you can check out those DVDs. And the Ringside membership is an incredible value, because if you become a Ringside member now, you can actually see Final Battle for free.
Oh, wow.
By signing up for a Ringside membership. It more than will pay for itself very quickly and is completely worth it, at least just for the library alone.
Mm-hmm.
The things you get to see, in addition to the deals you get on DVDs, early ticket releases, pay-per-view discounts, the whole deal. So that's really it. Final Battle is going to be a lot of fun. It's a, you know, Sunday afternoon, 2 p.m. bell time, so that's going to be interesting. And there's going to be, you know, stars of the past, present, future, Jerry Lynn's final Ring of Honor match, three-team sudden death rules for tag team titles. Matt Hardy returns to Ring of Honor to wrestle against Adam Cole. I expect a very warm welcome from the New York fans for Matt Hardy on the 16th.
Yeah, hopefully he's not driving his way intoxicated up there from North Carolina.
No, I'll tell you, we can joke about that now, but Matt has cleaned up his act.
Good, good for him, because last year he was a train wreck.
Oh, it was awful, and he'd be the first to tell you.
Yeah.
He made a lot of mistakes, and he's atoning for those mistakes, and he understands people's perception of him is what it is. But I had a long talk with him in Chicago, and I've chatted with him online several times since then. He's clear-minded and focused, and I'm very happy for him, because that's another kid that I've known for a long time, and I'm very happy to see him back where he should be. Everybody's entitled to make mistakes. It's when you repeat those mistakes time and time and time again, and you never learn from them, that I have a problem with. So Matt's made his mistakes. He's atoning for them, and I'll do everything I can to support him. But Final Battle is going to be great. I want to see it. You know, everybody check it out. And I think the broadcast is going to be tremendous. So we're looking forward to it.
And where is it, Kev? At the Manhattan Center?
At the Hammerstein Ballroom. It's going to be a lot of fun. So, the big room downstairs. There's good seats remaining if you want to see it live. And if you can't be there live, check it out on ROHWrestling.com.
And, Kev, we've procured our WrestleMania tickets, so we're going to be in town that weekend. So we're definitely going to plan to make it down there for Ring of Honor that weekend.
Absolutely. That's going to be, the biggest wrestling weekend of the of 2013. So,
Now, do you stick around for the weekend, or do you take off when Ring of Honor's done?
As soon as that show's over, man, I am out.
Nice.
I have a thing about vacating the premises as quickly as possible.
Yes.
Especially when it's New York. Oh my gosh. Yeah, I usually try. It's like, how quick, if I have a flight, how quick after the show? Like, is there a flight after the show? Could I make it? Oh, the last flight's at 10:30. No, I couldn't make it. Last flight's at 11. Let's see. If Final Bell rings at 10:30, maybe. No, I can't make it. I'm one of those guys, man. Get back to the hotel, get to sleep, get up early, go home, fly home, be with my family.
Nice.
Good.
Well, Mr. Kevin Kelly, thank you again for your generous time you've given us. Fun, as always, to go through 97. We're going to have you back on in a few months. We're going to get into 98. A lot of stuff to talk about that year, I think, right? It was kind of an important year.
Oh, my gosh. 98 was a huge year, and I have to look back. I wonder, what did more business? Probably 99, box office wise.
Yes. I think 99 was probably a bigger box office. I'd say, when we get there, I think 2000 was probably the creative peak, though. That seemed to be their best year, storyline and in-ring wise.
Right. But there was, there was one, I have to look back, if it was 98 or 99, they ran December 31st or December 29th or something like that. A midweek show in Memphis did like $450,000.
Jesus.
Wow.
It's just crazy,
That's nuts.
A Wednesday night. in Memphis. So anyway, yeah, let's do 98 soon. And thanks, guys, for all the fun and the feedback, and look forward to it. And if any fans want to comment about this or anything else, shoot me questions, send me notes, whatever, on Twitter at RealKevinKelly.
Yeah, and he will answer. So hit us up. You're one of our most requested guests. People have been dying for the second part of this podcast.
Yeah, I know. I was excited. I was really glad that we were able to get to it, and we had some fun with it.
Excellent. Yep. So, all right, Kevin, we'll talk to you soon. And, Scott, we'll be right back.
You got it, man. Thank you.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
How many pro wrestling news websites do you visit to get your daily news? 3, 4, maybe 5? Do yourself a favor and make that number 1. WrestleChat.net, the only professional wrestling news site that brings you all wrestling news all day long, and is home of the critically acclaimed Still Real to Us podcast, starring former CZW, ROH, and ECW announcer Eric Gargiulo and the champ Jeff Peck. That's WrestleChat.net. WrestleChat, it's where it's at.
So there's WrestleChat.net, indeed, where it's at. Great message board, plenty of news topics to browse, WWE, TNA, Ring of Honor, the Still Real to Us podcast, much, much more. It's the official place for the PTB headlines, and if you click the PTB gnome on the right of the screen, you will head directly to our Podbean page and our full catalog of shows. So check it out, WrestleChat.net, indeed, where it's at. Also, head to our message board, bigelow34.proboards.com. It's really where PTB began. Our written reviews, the territory wars, and so much more. So head to our message board, bigelow34.proboards.com. If you want a one-touch spot for our show, head to Stitcher.com and the Stitcher app for all phones and tablets, iPhones, Droids, whatever you got. Go to Stitcher.com for more details. We also can't forget our good friend Graham Cawthon and the history of WWE.com. It's the best research site you will ever find. Past ring results, pay-per-view reviews, and so much more. Graham's a good friend of the show. Always help you with what you need. So that's the history of WWE.com. We can't forget our good friend Jay Womet. Continues to battle with lymphedema. The guy's a warrior, folks. For a guy who's had so many medical problems, he's always in great spirits when he's on the show. He's one of our dearest friends. There's a great way you can help him out. Medical bills are not cheap, particularly with a very a unique condition like his. So head to our board, bigelow34.proboards.com, for more information. We'd also like to welcome our newest sponsor to the program, and that is the Wrestling Forum at twfnews.com. Listen, they're a wrestling forum, they're a blog site, but really they're much more than that. The guys at TWF are looking to create a wrestling media nation by affiliating with as many top-quality blogs, podcasts, and vodcasts as they possibly can. And that includes yours. They're the official forum of WrestleChat.net, and we here at The Place to Be have already joined up to have our podcast featured on there as well. So go check them out and find out what they're doing, what they're about, at twfnews.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Bruno Lauer, a.k.a. Harvey Whippleman, a.k.a. Downtown Bruno. I'm on The Place to Be. You're listening to The Place to Be podcast. And I'm going to tell you something right now. If you know about our business, our industry, the WWE, our sport, this is The Place to Be. The Place to Be podcast. You know why? Because it's like Mama said, it be that way sometimes.
All right, Nation, we are back, and this is going to be like an old-school Saturday Night's Main Event. You go to the break, and then you come back, and you wrap up 30 seconds later. But Kevin Kelly, awesome as always.
Wow, that was a great show. I can understand why he wanted to break it into two pieces, because
yeah,
that one cast could have been about 4 hours if we kept talking. So much information. And you know, for a guy who sometimes says that he wasn't in the know, he more in the know than he thinks. I mean, he was – yeah.
Well, he was around for a lot of good stuff, you know.
Yeah.
All right, so –
we'll definitely have him on, you know, maybe at the quarter point of 1998 and, you know, talk about those first, you know, few months. And we were just chatting, maybe have a little college football action as Knowles or his beloved Seminoles of Florida State playing this weekend in the ACC championship. So
yeah, he said he wants to rejoin us. Maybe we'll do a little old school NWA or something like that. Maybe the end of the month and December. Yep. We'll get him back on. All right, Scott, we are going to skip over NFL predictions for this week. We want to get the show up and posted. So for this week's predictions, just go to the Bigelow 34 ProBoards.com message board, and you can see our predictions for this week over there, and you can even join in and beat Scott like everyone else does.
Pretty much.
Yeah. So
bad year, I admit it.
All right, what do we got next week, Scott? I don't have the schedule in front of me. We have...
While I'm setting that up, again, Kevin Kelly was tremendous.
Yes.
You guys are, I'm glad you, I hope you enjoyed it, because he's definitely one of our favorite guys, and let me find it here, and we definitely want to have him back, we'll definitely have him back on. Let me find the schedule.
I believe Monday we're doing a Raw, correct?
Here we go. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Coming up on Monday the 3rd, again, this is all predicated, there's some, stuff on the home front going on again, so.
Card subject to change.
Yeah, card subject to change. Coming up Monday, we'll be recapping one of the most memorable Raws of 1998, and that's the one from April 13th from 1998. That was, of course, the possible first matchup in the ring between Vince and Stone Cold. And of course, that is the Raw that broke the streak of Nitro winning the Monday Night Wars.
And as of now, we're not planning to have that be a live review. We're gonna pre-watch that and review it that way. So
yeah, we want to give you guys a chance to because that's a show where the promos are so huge, you don't want us yapping over them. So
right.
We want you guys to listen to them. And then coming up on Wednesday, we will go back into the vault and we will do Unforgiven 1998 and our picks if we feel like it. if I feel like even caring, anybody wants to see me pick more bad teams.
Probably not. Well, they know who not to pick, so.
Yeah, exactly. And just to recap, and then the following week, we're going to go back-to-back nights. We'll have Over the Edge, 98, another one of our favorites. And then, actually, the headlines. So we'll bring back our man Kyle Forchetti in a couple weeks as we head on the road to TLC, as Mr. Kelly mentioned. Big ring of... That's a good double dip, huh?
I didn't realize it was the same day. I knew it was that weekend. I thought it was a Saturday. So that's really cool.
Ring of Honor at 2 o'clock, and then TLC at 8 o'clock in Brooklyn. So that's a great Sunday. So if you got the time and you got the schedule, take advantage of it. It's a fun day. Definitely a fun day. So there you go. That's the next couple weeks of...
Now bring us into our holiday spectacular week. We got a couple cool things planned there as well. So, all right, Scott, let's wrap up. We had another great week here on the PTB podcast, back in the swing of things. We'll be back Monday night with that Raw from April of 1998. And until then, everyone, have a great weekend. That's Scott. I'm Justin. For Kevin Kelly, we are out. Talk to you later.
Another guy hates Triple H.
Everyone hates Triple H. You should too.
No, never.
Yeah.
Never.
How about Derek Lewis?
We say it's foreground. Hope that we feel this way forever. You can plan a pretty picnic, but you can't predict the weather. It's Jackson times out of nine. Now if I'm lying, fine. The quickest muzzle, throw it on my mouth and I'll decline. King meets queen, then the puppy love thing. Together dream about that crib with the good yeah swing. On the oak tree, I hope we feel like this forever. Forever, forever, ever, forever, ever. Forever never seems that long until you're grown. And notice that the day-by-day ruler can't be too wrong. Miss Jackson, my intentions were good. I wish I could become a magician to abracadabra all the sadder. Thoughts of me, thoughts of she, thoughts of he. Asking what happened to the feeling that her and me had. I pray so much about it, need some knee pads. It happened for a reason, one can't be mad. So know this, know that everything's cool. And yes, I will be present on the first day of school and graduation. I'm sorry, Miss Jackson. Ooh, I am for real. Never meant to make your daughter cry. I apologize a trillion times. I'm sorry, Miss Jackson. Look at the way he treats me. She look at the way you treat me. Skiller knows they're homegirls and got your ass in up the creek, G. Without a pad on, you left to straddle and ride this thing on out. And the union girl ain't speaking no more, cause my dick all in, I'm out. I'm talking about jealousy, infidelity, and be cheating, beating. And the N to the G, they be the same thing. To who you placing the blame on? You keep on singing that same song. Let bygones be bygones. You can go and get the hell on you and your mom. I'm sorry, Miss Jackson. Ooh, I am for real. Never meant to make